This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. You know the mantra, markets do it better. It being just about everything, from trading stocks to pricing a Big Mac to finding faster ways to sell mortgages to more people. Well, on second thought, maybe not that last one.
In fact, the Great Recession that was triggered by the housing crash was propelled, at least in part, by the unbridled excesses of the financial sector. All of that may lead many, or some anyway, to doubt the notion that markets can do much social good.
So, what do you make of this?
With proper financial engineering, I am absolutely convinced we can solve cancer, the energy crisis, and global warming. I'm convinced.
So that's MIT professor Andrew Lowe. He's one of the world's leading financial thinkers. Time magazine named him to its 100 most influential people list. And you heard him correctly. Andrew Lowe believes that financial markets can play a key role in solving the greatest global challenges, including finding a cure for cancer.
So maybe some of you are dubious, but bear with us because Lowe's got a very compelling case to make, and we'll speak with him in just a moment. But part of his thinking stems from the fact that right now, many of the dollars that support basic cancer research comes from, you guessed it, the federal government. And you remember the congressional budget brawls of the past year.
One potential casualty, the National Institutes of Health, which faces deep budget cuts in 2013. We spoke with Shannon Pettypiece, healthcare reporter for Bloomberg News, to find out why.
Like many government agencies, the NIH is bracing for big budget cuts under this sequestration, this deficit reduction law. And you may remember when Congress a while back struggled to reach any sort of agreement on budget cuts, they did pass this deficit reduction law, automatic spending cuts that are going to go through unless Congress reaches some sort of agreement on how to cut the budget. And under that, there would be a $2.5 billion cut to NIH. And to put that into a little context, NIH's budget, it's around $30 billion. So that's a pretty sizable chunk that would come out of them. And those cuts would take place January 2nd. The hope is that Congress will reach some sort of deal because neither Democrats or Republicans want to see these cuts go through. But if you've been paying attention, it is hard for Congress to reach an agreement on anything these days. So this is a real fear that researchers are bracing for.
So $2.5 billion cut, Shannon, that's about 8%. So as you were saying, a large chunk of the NIH's budget. But is that going to affect researchers directly, or could some of that money be coming out of the NIH's administrative wing?
No, it is really going to affect researchers directly. At least that's the projections here.
Well, let's take a step back because, as you know, we're here in Boston and there are many, many research labs from, you know, the large ones at places like Harvard, MIT, et cetera, to smaller startups who rely on this direct funding from the government for fundamental research. So can you describe how important this NIH funding is to scientists working at a bench?
It's extremely important. This is where most of America's basic research is coming from. The big pharma, you know, the big drug makers, they've really cut back on basic early research. You know, they're sort of looking for their pipeline to come from outside the company in these biotech and academic centers that are all throughout Boston. So they depend on these NIH grants to help get them the new products that are going to be the next breakthrough blockbuster drug. And at the same time, too, there's a lot of research that industry and big pharma just isn't that interested in. Small diseases, really hard to treat, high-risk diseases, and some things that might not even seem that small to you, like ovarian cancer or pancreatic cancer. There's not a lot of research going on in those areas in big pharma. So the people who are doing that breakthrough research are the type of researchers who get this NIH funding.
And Shannon, a little earlier you mentioned accurately that it seems very difficult for Congress to get anything done in this day and age. But this particular budget crisis concern with the NIH is also a product of our political moment with the sequestration issue. Do you see NIH potentially getting on firmer footing regarding funding, or do you think these funding uncertainties are just going to be kind of a fact of life going forward?
I think that it is going to be a fact of life going forward. Regardless of what happens with sequestration, if Congress will probably reach some deal, they'll probably sort of kick the can down the road until March and then end up reaching some sort of deal. But NIH's budget has been in a real squeeze for a long time, and I talk to a lot of people who are involved in health policy in Washington, and they say that medical research and scientific breakthroughs aren't a priority right now. It's obviously jobs and the economy and balancing the budget and the deficit, and people aren't talking about the U.S. leading in science and healthcare and breakthroughs like they were even in the 1990s when there was this huge national effort behind the Human Genome Project and stem cells. Folks in Washington on the health policy side, they just don't feel like health and science is a priority, at least it's not as much as it used to be. So it's just really not a good time to be a scientist trying to get NIH funding these days.
Shannon Pettypiece is a Bloomberg News healthcare reporter. She joins us today from New York. Shannon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So tough times if you're a scientist seeking NIH funding. And this is exactly where Andrew Low wants to step in. He says if the government or even the pharmaceutical industry isn't adequately funding cancer research, then financial markets can. And with the efficiencies, maybe even risk tolerance and speed of innovation that are supposed to come with a market approach, Low believes labs could be developing cures for cancer in 20 years. Andrew Low is a professor, hedge fund manager, and director of the Financial Engineering Lab at MIT's Sloan School of Management, and he joins us in the studio now. Professor Low, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks very much for having me.
So let me begin by asking you, I understand that your interest in trying to find new ways to fund cancer research and other actually great global problems comes from some personal experience in your family that you've had with the disease. Can you tell us about that?
Well, sure. Last year, my mother died of lung cancer, and during the process of being treated for the disease, I learned a great deal about both the science of cancer as well as the business of cancer. Also, the donor of my endowed chair, Charles Harris, passed away from cancer a couple of years ago, and Charles was very open about the process by which he dealt with his disease, and it was very eye-opening for me.
What in particular was eye-opening? I mean, were you hearing people just being frustrated by the funding?
Well, that was certainly one part of it. It seemed like there was some kind of misunderstanding on the part of politicians about the urgency of funding for NIH, and that was frustrating. But there was an even bigger conundrum that I was dealing with, which is that we have these incredible breakthroughs on the scientific front for dealing with these kinds of diseases, and yet at the same time, there's less and less money going into this, both publicly and privately. And it just seemed to be very strange that we could at one hand become smarter about dealing with diseases, but on the other hand are pouring less money into it despite the fact that we're on the verge of some major breakthroughs.
Interesting, especially since depending on where you look, there's a lot of money going around.
Mm-hmm.
It just, you know, depending on who wants to harness it and for what.
Absolutely.
So you've written a paper about this. You've also spoken a few places to some very smart people who've come away with an impressive range of reactions. But let's sort of dig into what your big idea is here. I mean, it begins with the following premise, that to create a single effective cancer drug, it usually costs $200 million and takes about 10 years. So with that fact, where do you go from there?
Well, actually, it's even worse than that. The $200 million is just the out-of-pocket costs for researching one particular cancer compound. The fact is that you have to actually try a number of compounds before you actually find a successful one. So the actual total cost is in the billions of dollars. With that $200 million figure, the probability of success for any one compound is about 5%, and it takes 10 years to figure that out. So those are not very attractive odds for any kind of investor to invest in.
It sounds about what you'd get for, a government bond right about now.
Even worse. And so my co-authors, Jose Maria Fernandez and Roger Stein, we looked at the problem and said, you know, the financial approach is typically to use diversification, to use portfolio theory. If you've got low odds of success on any one trial, the answer is simply to do a lot more trials at the same time. The problem is that with cancer, at $200 million a trial, to do, say, 150 of these trials at the same time would increase your odds of success enormously, but that would cost you $30 billion. And so, not knowing any better, we just suggested that that was the right number for creating a cancer fund.
So a $30 billion cancer fund, that's what you're aiming for here.
Well, that's just a placeholder because it obviously depends on the kind of cancer and the particular approaches that you take. But it's really that order of magnitude. We're not talking about hundreds of millions. We're not even talking about billions. It's got to be tens of billions of dollars.
Okay. So for people who maybe aren't well-versed in a lot of financial language, when you talk about portfolio theory and diversification, I mean, this is basically one of the premises on which, say, if you invest in an index fund that you're doing, you're capturing a broad swath of a market, so to speak, and so you'll have some things that are risky, some things that aren't so risky, and by doing that, you supposedly increase your guarantee of a certain return?
Exactly. You've got the pioneers of modern finance telling us that instead of trying to pick a winner, whether it's Microsoft or Apple or General Motors, what you really ought to do is to take a very large portfolio of stocks and hold them together so that what you're going to get is their average. And even though you might not be able to pick a winner in any one given instance, when you have 500 of these stocks in a portfolio, you're likely to do reasonably well. Mm-hmm. You don't get fantastic returns that way. You know, Warren Buffett often says that he doesn't like to diversify. Instead of putting all your eggs in one basket, instead of not putting all your eggs in one basket, he says you ought to put your eggs in one basket and watch that basket very carefully. But the problem is that not all of us are Warren Buffett. And if you don't have those skills, actually diversifying is a pretty good thing to do.
Yeah, some of us get a little nervous when it comes to volatility, understandably so. So who exactly would you be pulling into your pool of investors to create a $30 billion fund?
Well, there are actually two different markets that we could tap. One is the institutional investor market. For example, pension funds. To give you one example, CalPERS, the California Public Employee Retirement System, they have $226 billion to invest. The Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund has about $530 billion to invest. The China's Sovereign Wealth Fund, their estimates are in the trillions of dollars. And so there are large pools of capital that are looking for investment opportunities that offer decent but not extraordinary rates of return. The second pool of investors could be just retail investors, individuals that are investing their 401k money. And in that case, you might have a very large pool of individuals that want to have a decent rate of return, but also want to be able to be part of this social mission to cure cancer.
Well, I've read some estimates, in your paper, where you say that you could have average returns in a fund like this range from somewhere between 9 and 11% on average annually. Like right now, that sounds phenomenal.
Well, that does sound good. But of course, there's risk behind that. So it's very clear that while you can get these rates of return on average, they're going to be fluctuations. And that's one of the reasons why we propose financing this not just with traditional vehicles like equity, but also to use debt financing. And of course, you mentioned in your introduction about the mortgage bubble. Obviously, that kind of tool is very powerful when used in the right way, but it could also be very dangerous when used in the wrong way.
So listeners, we'd like to hear from you. This is a very compelling, innovative, potentially even controversial idea that Andrew Lowe has come up with. Do you think that markets can be a force for social good? What do you make of the idea of a $30 billion investment fund to find a cure for cancer? And if you are a cancer researcher, does it matter to you where your funding comes from? Does this sound exactly what you need, like exactly what you need to keep your research going? Or are you a little worried about the market maybe choosing winners and losers when it comes to who gets potentially life-saving funding or research-saving funding to seek a cure for cancer? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, Andrew Lowe, we sort of talked about who would be an investor in this big fund, how it comes together. But how does it actually operate when it comes to giving, dollars to researchers? Would you be doing it through pharma companies or directly to labs?
Well, the short answer is I'm not sure, because I'm not an oncologist or a molecular biologist. And there you really need to have the expertise of the scientist to make those kind of decisions. But in broad terms, I think that you would need to do a variety of things in order to allocate the money properly. One, you would need to have licensing agreements with the major universities that produce the intellectual property that ultimately will turn into drugs and treatments for cancer. Second, you also need to invest in biotech as well as existing pharma companies, because they have a lot of the expertise and they also have a lot of the assets. In fact, somebody estimated that there's something like a 20-year backlog of compounds that have not been explored for anti-cancer properties. And a lot of these compounds are sitting on the shelves of pharma companies and biotech companies. So there's a lot of expertise in the industry, and we have to tap into that expertise by creating a kind of a consortium to be able to fund these various different ventures.
Let me ask you about that, because as I was thinking about this throughout the day, I thought, you know, to a certain degree, there already exists a market out there. I mean, you just described in part what it is. There are very well-funded, large, powerful pharma companies out there that do exactly what you're talking about. They assess the potential return of various lines of research for, you know, any number of diseases. And they intentionally put things on the shelf because they just don't think it's going to be worth it in the long run. So how is it that your idea, your fund, can encourage those companies to come to a different conclusion?
Well, so that's a great question. And let me say that a lot of these pharma companies are putting these compounds on the shelves, not because they don't think it's worthwhile in the long run, but exactly the opposite. It's because they're not sure it's going to be worthwhile in the short run. The problem with funding is that the patience of the investor actually affects how you spend that money. So, for example, if you get funding from a venture capitalist, that firm is going to be expecting you to achieve milestones in 2 to 3 years. Well, if you're researching cures to cancer, it may be 10 or 20 years before you actually see some real progress. So you need to have longer horizons. And private equity and public equity are not the ideal financing vehicles for that kind of patient investing process. What you need, in my view, is long-term debt. To give you one example, last year, MIT issued 100-year bonds. They issued $750 million of 100-year bonds, and the interest rate that they're paying is 5.6%, which, in my view, is a pretty low rate for borrowing for 100 years. Now, imagine if you could borrow for 100 years to cure cancer, what kind of science you could do with that money and the kind of translational medicine that you can support. You can take on all sorts of very risky projects, but if you do it over a large enough pool and you do it over a long enough period, you can actually reduce those kinds of risks.
Hmm. You know, the title of your paper includes the phrase, commercializing biomedical research through securitization techniques. So lots of financial words there. But for anyone who remembers sort of the phrases that were flying around when the housing market collapsed, this idea of securitizing mortgages was exactly one of the things that people that now look back on and say, my God, these complex financial instruments are what, you know, precipitated the financial recession. And so how is it that you've suggested using some complex instruments in your fund. Mm-hmm. How does that work, and how could you prevent them from, you know, sort of spinning out of control the way the mortgage securities did?
Well, so in fact, it was the financial crisis that got me to start thinking down this path and that got my co-authors and I to start doing the analysis that we did. Securitization, for those who aren't familiar, is the alphabet soup of all of these securities, the CDOs, the collateralized debt obligations, and the CDSs, the credit default swaps that were used to insure these instruments. Just to give you a sense of how large this market is, in 1996, the United States issued $480 billion of mortgage-related securities, mortgage-related debt. By 2003, just 7 years later, that number turned into $3 trillion. $3 trillion versus $480 billion, thanks to this technique of securitization and CDS and other innovations. That moment, when I looked at those numbers, that was for me the aha moment. That's the equivalent of E equal MC squared in finance, because what that showed me was that it was possible, with the right incentives, with the right structures, to create enormous pools of assets. And if we could direct those assets for different purposes, including social priorities like curing cancer, we could actually make a lot more progress. Now, we also have to be careful that we don't allow this to develop into the kind of bubble that the real estate market developed into. And I think we've learned a lot about how to trim those kinds of excesses. It doesn't mean we've solved the problem, because there's still a lot more research that needs to be done about what caused the financial crisis and what we can do to deal with it. But I think that we actually know a lot more about how to address those excesses and therefore be able to use these financial tools more responsibly.
Because I imagine some people hearing this are thinking, I take your point, Professor Lowe, but on the other hand, that same, you know, massive expansion of capital that was available is what ended up producing those secondary markets and even people ultimately betting against housing. Could we come up with a situation where we have hedge funds betting against research?
Well, it's unlikely that that would happen unless, of course, research were over-invested in. And, you know, there is always a chance of that. But one could argue that having hedge funds bet against these markets is actually useful information. In other words, we knew, thanks to John Paulson, that the housing market had grown far too big and that we ought to actually bring down these markets in a more orderly fashion. But the bottom line is that anytime you're dealing with financial securities, there are going to be potential excesses you have to worry about. You know, Warren Buffett called derivatives financial weapons of mass destruction. And he has a point there. But remember also that along with weapons of mass destruction, there's also very good uses for those kinds of sources of energy like nuclear power. And so we have to understand how to use the tools properly and make sure that the abuses don't occur.
I'm speaking with Andrew Lowe. He's a professor of finance and the director of the Laboratory for Financial Engineering at the MIT Sloan School of Management. And he's also co-author of a new paper where he suggests creating a $30 billion fund that would go towards finding a cure for cancer and basically using the instruments of modern-day financial engineering to solve the world's great problems. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Liz is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Liz.
Oh, hi. I was wondering what would keep this prevent this entity from evolving into the typical huge corporation that watches its bottom line watches is controlled by its shareholders, just like Big Pharma.
Liz, thank you for your call. Professor Lowe, this is something that in the reading that I was doing to prepare for today that did come up, because, for example, you're telling us that venture capitalists wouldn't necessarily be interested in this because the rate of return is lower than they'd like. But on the other hand, you know, as Liz says, we do see times of shareholder activism and basically owners in these pursuits saying you got to stay on track. Now, science doesn't necessarily always operate on a particular path. You can't force discoveries according to a timeline.
That's right. And I think that's one of the reasons why you need $30 billion. If you started small, you could actually find one or two molecules that you want to develop and be able to bet some source of your assets on that relatively small kind of a bet. But if you want to do the really path-breaking research, if you want to develop drugs that are not just simply me-too drugs, you really have to take on enormous amounts of risk. And in order to take on enormous amounts of risks, you have to create size. And I think the answer to Liz's question about why this is not going to turn into another pharma company is a couple of things. One is the size, the magnitude that we're talking about is going to be sufficiently large. And the sources of financing, that is debt financing, that's long-term debt, is going to change the incentives of the corporate entity to be able to focus on some of the more risky, the more speculative, but hopefully the more radical and breakthrough kinds of therapeutics that are out there. It's really the scale of it that I think is going to change the dynamics. But the bottom line is that we actually are hoping that this entity is going to be focused on the bottom line. In other words, only by generating profits for bondholders and stockholders are we going to raise $30 billion. Otherwise, it's charity. And while charity is very important and it plays a really significant role in fighting cancer, it's of much smaller magnitude.
Robert is calling from Chinatown. You're on the air, Robert.
Hi, I just had a quick comment. I work in the microbiology department at Tufts University, and my stepmom is a cancer researcher. I think that this, and I don't want to get ahead of myself, but this conversation is very exciting because I want to go into research myself, and I'm going to spread this as much as I can and look up the paper as well that you've been mentioning, and very exciting, and I just wanted to encourage the conversation. Thank you very much.
Robert, thank you. Thank you so much for your call. Professor Lowe, I am curious because you said ultimately yes, because it is a fund, it is an investment vehicle, the bottom line does matter. But for example, when we were, let's harken back to those mortgage-backed securities, if we can for a moment, those things were backed by actual assets. Mm-hmm. Now here in this case, what is the asset that's holding up this fund such that your big investors, you're talking about pension funds, you know, they don't want to just be giving away their money. Mm-hmm. What are those actual assets that they can look at and say, yep, this is what's basically backing our fund?
Well, in this case, the assets are research, in particular biomedical research at a variety of different stages. Obviously, research at the very earliest stages are the most speculative. It's very hard to tell whether any particular research project will turn into something useful for cancer. As that research becomes more refined and it starts to get into preclinical and then phase one, phase two, phase three trials, it becomes clearer and clearer. The risk gets lower and lower that it's going to be useful. So the portfolio that I'm envisioning with the $30 billion is going to constitute assets at all the different phases of the clinical process. It'll have basic research in the form of technology licensing agreements with various different universities, revenue sharing agreements where you purchase interests in royalty streams, as well as compounds that it will own after it gets to the point where you get to phase two and phase three and you know that there's something of value. And it will buy and sell these compounds and intellectual property in order to benefit its shareholders and bondholders.
We've got just under a minute to go here. And my last question to you is this. I mean, as you heard Robert say, he's excited by this idea. It is a compelling one. But on the other hand, I imagine that no matter how much we discuss this and how many equations and promises can be made, there are many people out there who are still suffering the effects of the Great Recession. And to them, they're thinking, no way, no how. Financial markets have only shown us one thing in the past 10 years, and that is they eventually spin out of control. So why would we want to put something like cancer research in that kind of market where ultimately it is about profit and the bottom line?
Well, so I think there's a very simple answer to that question. The American Cancer Society estimates that the probability that a U.S. male will get cancer at some point in his life is 1 out of 2. And for females, it's 1 out of 3. So pretty much every one of us is either going to be faced with cancer or someone we love is going to be dealing with cancer. We wrote a $40 billion check to General Motors in order to bail them out, even though they weren't a finance company, because a lot of people were going to be out of work. Breast cancer kills 30,000 women every single year. That's 10 times more than the lives we lost in 9/11. So I think this is an absolute national priority. And if we understand the implications of that priority, I think this form of financing can actually be a quite important component of that solution.
Andrew Lowe is a professor of finance and the director of the Laboratory for Financial Engineering at the MIT Sloan School of Management. Professor Lowe, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, let us know what you think, and you can read his paper also all online at radioboston.org. Stay with us, because coming up, NPR's Bill Littlefield joins us to talk about retirement woes of NFL players. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.